KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
You listen, if you listen and learn, then you're going to be able to do anything you want next time.
Everybody thinks show business.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone Hollywood.
This week on The Business, the filmmaking twins, Mark and Michael Polish, on releasing For Lovers Only, a romance in black and white, on iTunes. Plus, the three college friends behind the new indie hit, Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene. But first, it's the Hollywood News Banter. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
You can imagine Hollywood, everything is really driven by
making money.
What's with him?
Oh, I'm afraid he's gone to Hollywood.
I'm joined by my fellow banterer, John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. Hello, John.
Hello, Kim.
So, John, I don't know about you, but I have been reading about something that Steve Jobs apparently had a eureka moment on before he died, and this was a project that was close to his heart. It was something that seems to be Apple TV.
He said famously in his new biography, "I finally cracked it." The direct quote is, "I'd like to create an integrated television set that is completely easy to use. It would be seamlessly synced with all of your devices and with iCloud. It will have the simplest user interface you could imagine." So, Kim, you could throw away your 14 remote controls.
Right, all of them. I think it sounds great. I have no idea quite what it is and how it works, but it seems to me if Apple can execute without Steve Jobs, and we don't know how far along, you know, when he says he cracked it, how far along it was or is, it seems to me like this could have a big impact on the industry, a big impact on all of our lives, just, of course, as iTunes and iPod had on the music business.
Obviously, television is a much bigger business than the music business right now. So there are billions of dollars out there to be made, and Apple has billions of dollars to spend. If they're unable to find content through traditional means, they could create their own network. They could buy up content if they needed to. And listen, I look forward to the day when watching and programming and recording and rewinding your TV is a lot easier than it is right now.
Yeah, me too. And if Apple is going to come in with a packet of money to buy content, the studios will definitely celebrate, because with the loss of that DVD revenue, it really just is a crushing problem that is impacting the business in dramatic ways, which is something that, you know, has been very much on display in recent weeks. We have seen some of the biggest names in the movie business sort of being put through it. Some of these huge producers, and I'm talking about Brian Grazer and Ron Howard, who had the plug pulled on their Dark Tower project at Universal. Frank Marshall and Kathy Kennedy, huge producers. Frank Marshall is now doing The Bourne Legacy, the next Bourne Identity series movie. And Kathy Kennedy has been doing a lot of movies. They go way back with Steven Spielberg. She's produced Tintin and War Horse, and they go back to the Indiana Jones days and beyond. So 2 years without a green light at Sony, which is a relatively producer-friendly studio. And as we talked about last week, John, Jerry Bruckheimer going through all kinds of contortions to get a green light from Disney on The Lone Ranger. So these guys used to be able to have their will, you know, was sort of carried out by the studios, and life has just changed so dramatically for them.
No, it used to be that the studios loved to have producer deals. They loved to be surrounded by powerful producers. The thinking was that they would bring them great scripts, they'd package movies, they would be kind of their aide-de-camps. And I think what has turned out to be true is that very often those producers will go to another studio to make a film there. They have huge overhead costs. They earn a fee, often a gross percentage of revenues. And good projects tend to come to the studios anyway. I think the studios are waking up to the fact that they may not need these people to bring them great scripts, that the great scripts will find the buyers if the studios are willing to spend the money.
Well, the producers certainly would argue the other way. They would argue, and included in this is like Marshall Herskovitz, who is just is president emeritus of the Producers Guild of America, that they are the ones who have the vision, who go out and develop it, who have to execute it. And when the studios come in, as they are increasingly doing, and send their executives onto the set and try to sort of function as producers, it undercuts that process of the person who brings passion and vision, and it sort of leeches that out of the process. And what you get is what we are seeing, increasingly homogenous movies, and, you know, a little bit of audience disinterest in some of the movies that are supposed to be these big tentpole films.
I have a feeling that these producers will figure out how to make their money, even if it's going to require that they not get this year's Jaguar.
Yeah, well, they're definitely not getting the Jaguar, but they are, according to the people that we talked to, they're just going to have to be more enterprising and, you know, find other sources of money to get their projects done. And speaking of which, it's now the time of year when people who got their projects done, even if they weren't necessarily in the studio mold, are entering the awards race. And I have to say, you know, John, it seems like last year, very different picture from what we're looking at this year in the awards competition.
I would absolutely agree. And it's easy to look back at last year in retrospect and pretend to be smart now. But at this point a year ago, people at festivals or in early screenings had seen Social Network, King's Speech, Black Swan, Winter's Bone, Inception, Kids Are All Right, Toy Story 3, 127 Hours, all of which were shortlisted for the Best Picture race. And I think a lot of people in town are saying right now they don't know what those films are. And this is the year in which there could be five Best Picture nominees, there could be 10. And I think a lot of people are scrambling trying to figure out what those movies are or if in fact they exist and if it's going to be a limited year in terms of Best Picture nominees.
Yeah, last year to me, by this time, it was sort of clearly seemed to be Social Network versus King's Speech with potential for a surprise. And there is a tradition of, you know, waiting until late in the year and then the Academy, the voters sort of want to discover that little movie that wasn't necessarily out there so early. It didn't happen that way last year, and King's Speech did go through and win. But we all remember Million Dollar Baby coming in, you know, kind of being moved onto the field of play late and then going on to win. So this year, I would say the field feels really wide open for something to be discovered because it just doesn't feel like the field is gelling at all.
So maybe there still is a shot for a very Harold and Kumar 3D Christmas in the Best Picture race.
Thank you, John.
Thank you, Kim.
That's John Horn of the Los Angeles Times. You can join in the conversation on our Facebook page, KCRW's The Business, or leave a comment on our website, kcrw.com/thebusiness. Mark and Michael Polish are identical twins who have been fixtures in the independent film world since they made their Sundance debut in 1999 with Twin Falls, Idaho, a drama in which the brothers played conjoined twins. That film brought them deals with Sony Pictures Classics and the now-defunct Paramount Classics for films like Jackpot and North Fork. But they've remained idiosyncratic and independent. That's clear from their latest film, For Lovers Only, which took a different route into the marketplace. They didn't seek the usual exposure at festivals or even in theaters. The film debuted on iTunes in July, and to date it's grossed more than $300,000 through various digital platforms and movies on demand. The brothers made For Lovers Only, on the cheap and on the fly. They say they got it done for the price of a trip for three to France. Mark Polish wrote the film and stars in it with the actress Stana Katic, who has a following thanks to a role on the ABC series Castle. Michael Polish not only directed, but did almost everything else, from scouting the locations to editing. The film is about two lovers who accidentally reconnect and resume a passionate affair.
Are you still taking photos of beautiful girls?
No. Not anymore.
Oh, please don't tell me that that gets old.
It doesn't. I got old.
You're not old.
I'm losing my eyesight. Oh, that's what they told me.
What are you talking about?
I'm not seeing what they wanted to see. You know, the editors, magazines.
What are you seeing?
You, pieces of you and everything.
The film is in black and white. It's the Polish brothers' homage to the French New Wave, something they'd wanted to make for years. They finally attacked it last spring.
I knew I didn't want to shoot during the summer, and there was a spring moment, and Mark just finished writing another draft of it, and I was going to Paris, and I said, let's see if we can pull this off. I have the cameras already. You show up with an actress, and we'll make this movie.
So he says to bring you an actress, yes. And where do you go about? You find an actress.
The king says, bring me an actress.
Bring me an actress. Bring me an actress. She must be beautiful. But she is beautiful, Stana Katic. Yeah. She's in Castle.
Yes.
She's a TV star.
Yes, she sure is.
And where do you find this person?
You ask your agent if there's someone willing to do the things necessary to pull this film off.
And jump off cliffs.
Jump off cliff, ride a 650cc motorcycle, that, you know, do those things that were required in the script. And fortunately, I've had an agent long enough to understand Mike and I's crazy side. And she put together a list of girls that were, or actresses that were at the agency that were at UTA. And Stana's name was at the top. And Mike immediately recognized that name.
I saw an episode of her. And when her name came up, I associated. I said, that's the girl on Castle. And I then started to see photographs of her. I started to research her look. And I said, wow, she's not captured the way that she should be captured. Obviously, as a TV show, and there's a specific look. I think she photographs very well. I said, let's see if we can explore that. Let's see her. And she was very charming and very adventurous. And I said, we need an actress like this.
And she was all up into
she
it
was
because
into
of
it,
the
yeah.
millions of dollars that you offered
her. Yeah, of course,
her.
Yeah. She's, uh-huh. I mean, we threw a check down and said, put your number and we'll sign you up. I think she, you know, it takes an artist to know an artist in the sense that she's, at heart, she's an artist. And she recognized, hey, this is an opportunity to do something that not very many people are doing, which, you know, on one side looks crazy, but on the other side is very expressive. And being in the environment that she is on the TV, it's very corporate and it's very constricted. And this was the time to take that straight jacket off and go have some fun. And
so
I think
how long were you going to ask her to come to Paris for?
I think it was 2 weeks. We were there for 14 days. We shot in 12.
You shot in 12 days?
And I was there 6 weeks, yeah. I think, 6 or 7 weeks.
Just doing locations?
Yeah, I was running around trying to, just exploring Paris, exploring where the light was, and shifting churches I liked, places I wanted to go. And I also took a tour of the castles I wanted to shoot them in. And I also went down to southern France. So I pre-mapped it out for them. So they would just be able to be the characters in the film and not have to worry about locations or where we're going to shoot.
I mean, did you have a crew? Was anybody
no.
with you?
No. I was transpo. I drove the motorcycle to set. I drove the car to set. I gave you baguettes every once in a while.
Yeah.
I gave them their call times.
So you had literally nobody helping you at all?
I had an assistant that helped organize a lot of the running around.
And we had hair and makeup for her. Stana.
I mean, did you have to get permission to shoot on locations?
We haven't.
You're supposed to. We're still supposed to ask for permission. I mean, I guess you do and ask for permission.
We'll claim artist residency of France.
Yeah.
I see. Okay. Uh-huh. And so, but you really are, I mean, when you do this,
yes.
are you thinking, and then we're going to do iTunes?
No, it's funny because we were talking prior today about when I'd left, Mike and I had a conversation on the phone about, you know, this could be the first feature released on iPad. Because iPad came out, I think, about 12 hours before I left. The first one, there was the mad rush, and we were talking about it, and we looked at it. And so we kind of jokingly said, hey, this would be a great movie for the format, and the camera kind of lends itself to that. To that distribution model. But when we finished and we cut it, we had a screening down here on Wilshire. We thought, you know, it sustains itself to be a theatrical release. But as we were showing it to distributors, you know, the black and white is kind of a kiss of death. I don't think they feel that there's an audience for it. And obviously we found out there was a big audience for it.
So you meet with the distributors. Yeah. They're kind of like, yeah, guys.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is that there was a few offers, but within those offers in the deal memo, there was a color version to be delivered as well.
So were there color?
We shot it in color because we felt that, you know, obviously from a cinematographer's point of view, it's just richer for us. It was richer for us to have a color version and then flip it black and white.
Oh,
And that was something that we didn't. Going back to, there were deal breakers to us because if we handed over or gave them the opportunity to release color, that they would. And territories in this film would show up in color in certain
areas.
Sure,
they would.
And we felt that wasn't our intention, so we wanted to hold the color version.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with the filmmaking twins, Michael and Mark Polish. Their latest movie, For Lovers Only, was shot guerrilla style in France with no work permits and no crew. The brothers didn't worry about a theatrical release. After some informal screenings, they found they just wanted to get the movie out there somehow. So they went to John Sloss from Cinetic Media, a company that helps filmmakers use various non-theatrical platforms to reach an audience.
He had the track record that we appreciated.
Yeah,
he had a team together.
He had Restrepo before that, and he had Exit to the Gift Shop, which we thought were good titles to follow up. And so that kind of avenue was attractive to us. We knew that if he could just get them into the areas like an iTunes and use his contacts, because they don't do deals with independent filmmakers per se, if he could just put those in the platforms, we would take it from there.
His model, just as a rights dealer, was very, very romantic to us because it got the movie out as quickly as possible and as to many people as we could get it to. And
we weren't concerned about how many people saw it and when they saw it. We felt it was more of a street art idea behind it. It was more like a Banksy, where it's around, you'll see it if you're walking by it, and then you can admire it once you see it.
So how did you guys, how did you set about publicizing?
It was interesting because there was just no recipe of how we were going to do it. It was Michael and I had a dialogue about pretty much saying non-promotion, where we weren't going to promote it at all. We weren't going to do one thing. And I had a small Twitter account and, you know, a few followers here and there. And Stana had a much larger one. And we thought, look, we'll just tweet and let people know that, hey, this is where you can see this movie. This is our movie. I have fans and she has fans. At that point, hundreds and hundreds of tweets started to come in. And really, you know, at 140 characters, there are very, very strong reviews. And since, like, I've never seen anything like this, this is intimate. And
which
I started.
It could be ambiguous.
Yeah.
I've never seen anything.
And I started
like this.
To see them, and I'm like, well, you know, we didn't have critic screenings. We didn't have any reviews. This is kind of our review. So I started taking about 300 per one sheet of reviews from Twitter, and I started putting them where the critics would speak on our one sheet. So I had three or four different one sheets with about 300 to 400 Twitter accounts on it. And I started sending those back out to Twitter. And then that started to take off. And the storm of tweeting started happening. The word of mouth started to get really big. So social networking was a big, big help in this movie.
Did you know going in, did John say to you, John Sloss, if you get this many downloads, you will then start to make a profit?
No. There was no conversation with him about a profit or any kind of revenue. It was basically put it out there. We know the cut between what you get, what we get, and what iTunes get. And that
there's there's no money against the movie.
Yeah, there was no money against
it. It was basically a service deal.
Yeah, it was a service. Right. And it
you
was
didn't
up
have to pay off
no,
any investors.
No. Mm-hmm. And it was up to us to promote and get it out there, get the word out there.
Does that leave anything for you guys to have fun with?
Oh, yeah, of course. I mean, it's not, you know, an embarrassment of riches, but it's enough to make another movie in this form and fashion. Yeah.
Which you want to do?
Yeah. I think there's a way to keep making these type of movies. I mean, the avenue's open now to make these type of...
The movie's done extremely well for what we did. And that's we're very proud of that we did a movie for basically nothing in terms of what movies are usually made for, and the profit margin started with the first rental.
You have to have a very small cast.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
How important was Stana Katic to the success of the film? She, I mean, because she does have a 60,
following. 60,000 tweets.
Yeah.
How many?
75,000 followers, important.
That seems important to
Me. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, you look at those almost as shareholders now. You know, they're almost their own little corporations, these celebrities, with their Twitter accounts. So you can almost identify, like, how much attention you're going to get with that star or that celebrity in your movie.
I mean, if you were going to do something like this again, if you are going to do, would you say, I mean, you guys obviously renounce a great deal in pursuit of what you want to your vision, but would you feel like, but it would be nice to have a star of that level or greater who can boost us along on the way?
Sure. I mean, I think anytime you can make anything a little bit easier to, you know, brand recognition is, you know, what this whole idea is about.
And what about you? Do you think the film has helped to brand you too?
Like a pair of Levi's?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's funny because we've gotten a lot more recognition for this than maybe our prior films. I think people like to sometimes see this aspect of this kind of punk rock mentality, or, you know, pick up this film and use it as a stone to throw at Hollywood as, you know, that model's bad and this is great. And, you know, we're not activists here. We love making movies, and this is just a way that we made a movie.
Yeah,
and
there's no problem with the Hollywood system. They spend money to make movies, and we don't. They make great big movies, and Christmas Day is great to get a big gift.
Well, I want to thank both of you, Mark and Mike, for coming in. I almost looked at the wrong brothers when I said
right.
Mark and
that's
Mike.
Right. It all works for
you
us.
Can always reverse it.
Yes, but I do want to thank both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so appreciate much. It.
Coming up after a short break, the college friends behind the indie movie Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene. You're listening to The Business from KCRW and KCRW.com.
Hi, this is Darby Maloney, producer of The Business. Thanks so much for listening. Our show costs money to make, and we're dependent on listeners like you to make it. KCRW is a nonprofit, listener-supported public radio station. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. The indie film, Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene, is a harrowing look at the fallout from a woman's experience in a cult. It stars Elizabeth Olsen, younger sister of the Olsen twins, in a well-reviewed performance, and John Hawkes, the intense character actor who earned an Oscar nomination last year for Winter's Bone.
Focus. Take a deep breath. Feel the tension leaving your stomach and moving to your hands. Think of someone who hurt you, who lied to you. Feel it. Feel how they made you feel. Let it build. Let it transfer to the gun. Building in the gun. Breathe out. Release. Feels good, right?
Martha Marcy May Marlene premiered at the Sundance Film Festival earlier this year and was quickly snapped up by Fox Searchlight. It comes from a small New York production company, Borderline Films, that was started by three friends, Sean Durkin, Antonio Campos, and Josh Mont. They met at the NYU Film School, and since graduating in 2006, they've kept their company afloat by directing music videos and taking on editing and video projects. The company made one other feature-length film before Martha, the 2008 After School, written and directed by Campos. It played on the festival circuit, but Martha, written and directed by Durkin, has put the three friends in a new place. Fox Searchlight is giving the movie the kind of rollout that could be a game-changer for them. Matt Holzman, host of the KCRW film series and blog, Matt's Movies, recently sat down with the filmmakers.
At what point after you guys met did you realize that you wanted to work together? And what was
first
the
first day? Mm-hmm. I met Sean the first day of class, and we just, there are not many kids who are from New York who grew up in Manhattan, and it's a small thing we bonded on, but that was the immediate thing that started us to talk. And then we just started talking about film, what we wanted to do and work, and like how excited we were, and just what we were trying to get at NYU. And it just kind of was this organic friendship and partnership. And then I think within a week, I knew Antonio was at our school, and Antonio was kind of like this prodigy. People knew about him making films at 13.
He had buzz then.
Yes. He had heat, as right. You guys in LA say it. So then but we ran into him on the street, and we talked. I heard he made a short film, and we talked about the experience, and I immediately was like, well, you need a new producer. I could have done this and that.
Wow.
And then we just started seeing what you had and what we had, and mm-hmm. we exchanged materials, and then both the materials were probably not that good.
Yeah, we were both mutually underwhelmed by each other's work at the time.
I don't think that's...
No, it's true. I mean, stuff at the time. I mean, what was evident was the shared ambition that we had and the shared sort of feeling that film school is ephemeral. I mean, this period's going to end, and we all want to sort of figure out what's going to happen when we get out of here.
Yeah, and there was also a fear for all of us of just... like financially, well, even being in school, how to financially support ourselves. And when we got out of school, it was like a big fear of mine. I think of all of us, and it was really important to like try and position ourselves when we got out of school so that we could actually, get apartments and pay rent and pay our loans and stuff,
And the other thing for me, it was Sean and Josh had transferred in, and I had been at NYU for a year already. And I had only applied to one film school. I applied to one school out of high school, which was at NYU. I just wanted to go to NYU my whole life. And I got there, and I was incredibly disappointed with the atmosphere in the school. There's this kind of, there's a certain kind of arrogance to a lot of kids that get into NYU. And I had a hard time really connecting with people. There was a weird kind of like animosity towards me at certain points. I felt like, well, you've made a bunch of short films already. I was also making short films that upset people, even at that time, and so the group of people that would actually like sort of be friends with me after a while was smaller and smaller. Then luckily, when I met Sean and Josh, it was like we immediately became friends, and it was like, oh great, okay, now we can
all make movies that upset
now
people.
Now we can all make movies.
We can do it together.
Upset people that eventually.
Well, you've brought up money, and I want to ask you, and maybe Sean will ask you this question. You're in school, you have loans. How do you decide you're going to make movies when movies cost money, and where did you find the money?
Well, we made movies that didn't cost money.
Ah.
We made...
Well, they cost some money.
Yeah, but, in comparison, in 2004 when we made Buy It Now, Antonio scrounged together that money from like a few family members and like a friend of your mom's, right? I mean, and that, and we made that for like $1,000. And then we took that model and applied it to the other short films we made. And it was, you know, doing that, where other people at school at that time were spending, I mean, I remember in 2004, 2005, hearing that some kid had spent like $80,000. And that wasn't uncommon at that point in time.
And now you have a kind of an unusual situation because you have three people who are capable of writing and directing and producing. How are you dividing the duties? How does that work, Sean?
With the narrative stuff, it's whoever creates it just is the
So if you came
director.
Up with the script, Sean,
if I come up with that idea,
then the other two are the producers.
Yeah, yeah, that's without saying. And with the short form work, it's, you know, if it's a music video, it's oftentimes like the song or the style. It just, there's never been a question for some reason. We've never sat down and been like, oh, well, I want to do this. Oh, well, I want to do this. You know, it was just always very clear when something comes in, we understand who should do it.
Antonio, I wonder, as you become more successful, though, if you feel like you're going to end up having to specialize more in your duties. Someone will produce music, video, commercial.
No, no. What we set out to do from the very beginning was to make films. And we all wanted to make the films that we wanted to make as writer-directors. And Sean and Josh, in my case, like I wanted to make their films, too. Do you know what I mean? Like I love them as brothers, and I love them as partners, and creatively we're all in sync. And when Sean has an idea and he wants to go down that road to make that into a film, I will throw everything that I have so that I can see that film too.
But I, you know, with the success of this film, which whether it makes any money at the box office or not, is a successful film because people love it, and because it's being distributed by Fox Searchlight, a smaller division of a major studio, you can expect that people are going to be coming to you and saying, we really want you to direct this $50 million, $100 million movie, and that is going to change the dynamic between you dramatically.
I mean, not necessarily. I don't think those offers are actually coming in. But but it's not, because what the great thing is that over the years, certain offers have come in, like Antonio did really well as a director of After School, and there were opportunities, and we always said no, like we're creating this company and we're sticking together, and this is just how it is. And then people didn't understand that, and now with Martha and this year, people started to understand that. So the people who are coming to us and talking about projects, they come into the meeting knowing that this is how it works. One person directs, the other two are producers.
I see. Do you guys all have the same representation?
Yes.
Yeah. You do? Mm-hmm. For all the kinds of work that you do?
Yeah.
Yep.
That's unusual, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, there was a point where after school, there was a commercial agency that wanted to sign me, and we met with them a couple times, and, you know, we kept pushing for all of us to get signed together, and they said, well, you know, eventually we can do that, but let's start off with just you, and then we didn't go with them, and that was just the right choice to make.
Antonio Campos, Josh Mond, Sean Durkin are Borderline Films. Sean has written and directed a movie produced by Antonio, and Josh is their model. It's called Martha, Marcy, May, Marlene. It's a remarkable film being released by Fox Searchlight. Well, thanks so much for coming down, and I hope in a couple of years or whenever the next big film comes, you'll come back and we'll follow up this story.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thanks, guys.
For a longer interview with Sean Durkin, listen to this week's episode of KCRW's The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell. And that's The Business. Darby Maloney produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna and Jenny Radelet. To make a comment about today's show, go to kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can listen to us on demand with our KCRW smartphone apps, and you can always subscribe to the podcast through iTunes. The Business is produced and distributed by KCRW. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.
KCRW sponsors include Make It Universal and Rotten Tomatoes, presenting Scene on Screen with Jacqueline Coley, a brand new podcast about the people at NBC Universal and the movies that define them. Available wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.